Hey, you guys, this is The Mean Podcast, and I'm your host, Kristen Filipkowski. The Mean Podcast is where I talk to creative, curious, and ambitious women who are diving headfirst into the second half of their lives. Turning 50 doesn't mean it's time to fade into the background. It means we know what we're doing, and we're not afraid to do it. Hey, everyone. Welcome back to the show. This week's interview is with Tamar Miller, founder of luxury shoe brand Bells and Becks. Tamar's experience in the retail space is impressive, to put it mildly. She's been head of merchandising at Old Navy Online, head of merchandising at Banana Republic Online, director of merchandising for women's shoes at Piperlime, and earlier in her career, she was a buyer at Macy's and Pottery Barn. Her education is equally stellar. She graduated from UC Berkeley and Harvard Business School, and at a time when she had reached what some might call the pinnacle of her career, she decided to jump off the corporate ladder and become an entrepreneur. When we recorded our interview, we were in the earlier stages of the coronavirus pandemic, and you can probably hear in our voices that we're both a little shell-shocked. Tamar had returned from Italy, of all places, just weeks before, so you don't want to miss that story. We also discuss how becoming an entrepreneur when you are approaching 50 might be unconventional, but it also might be optimal. This is a really meaty conversation that I think you'll get a lot out of, especially if you happen to be an entrepreneur. Tamar goes into some detail about her decision-making around slowly but steadily growing her shoe brand and how bootstrapping the business has served her very well. She also shares some gems about her experience with Facebook advertising and her thoughts on the pros and cons of a brick and mortar shop. And as always, we also touch on the personal perks of getting older. I really enjoyed this conversation with Tamar, and I learned so much. I hope you will too. We're talking with Tamar Miller, who is the founder of luxury shoe brand Bells and Becks. Hi, Tamar.
Hi, Kristen.
How are you?
I'm doing okay, as well as can be expected, I suppose, under the current circumstances. How are you?
Yes. Same. Same. So we are recording in the midst of the coronavirus pandemic, and unfortunately, we're both sheltering in place. And are you in Burlingame?
I am, yeah. And you're also in the Bay Area, correct?
I am. I'm in Pacifica, so sort of just right down the road. Your path to me is very interesting because you went to Harvard Business School and you also went to Berkeley, and you seem obviously very business-minded, but then you also have a creative side with the shoes. Now, do you design the Bells and Becks shoes yourself? Do you have partners in that, or how does that work?
Yeah, so I do design the shoes myself. I work with factories, and I have several suppliers that I work with, and they have internal designers that help me bring the vision to life. And I typically work off of inspiration and ideas and sort of put this together with that, with, you know, an end goal in mind. And they help me bring that vision to life. So yes, I am the designer. And this is, I would say, my first foray into design. My background and experience is all in retail merchandising and digital merchandising. So I never actually really brought the product to life from, you know, zero to 100. This is the first time I've ever done that. So that's been fun and interesting. And I guess I would say one of the highlights actually of starting Bells and Becks.
Oh, that's so cool. And you founded Bells and Becks, is it 4 years ago?
It's actually been the official launch date was 2 years ago. It's okay. Believe it or not, it was March. I say believe it or not because it feels like a lifetime ago considering what I thought the 2-year anniversary was going to look like this month. But it was 2 years ago in March was the official launch. And I started concepting the business probably 9 months prior to that. So it's been, you know, 2.5-ish to, you know, almost 3 years since really the beginning, you know, kind of germination of the brand, I would say.
Is there something in particular that you really love about shoes and designing them?
I've just always loved shoes as a category ever since I was a little girl. But I think as I've grown, I think I'm drawn to footwear because it's one of the few categories that combines true function and fashion. There's an absolute function to footwear, and At the same time, I view shoes to be wearable art. Mm-hmm. And I think in general, I love accessories, and I love accessories of all kinds, whether it's fashion or home decor. I actually, once upon a time, used to be the decorative accessories merchant at Pottery Barn. And it was, you know, a category that I was pretty excited about. Yeah. So I love art in general. And for me, footwear is, you know, there's so much design and detail that goes into it. And at the same time, there's a function, and it's actually a very complex production process. And there's a lot of know-how that's involved in producing footwear. And that's why I love producing footwear in Italy in particular, because they are truly, they're called artisans for a reason. And they are masters of a craft that, you know, requires a lot of technical skill and know-how, but also a creative element. And so I think that's why I'm drawn to the category.
That makes sense. Yeah. And is it clear at all when you'll be able to go back to Italy? Or maybe it's good that you were just there. So you've made a trip recently. Are you going to need to go back anytime soon for the business?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what's going to happen. The factories have all shut down. They're meant to reopen sometime in April. And the plan was to, you know, I go there several times a year to work with the factories and for, you know, design trips and just, you know, following up from a product perspective. So the plan was to go in a couple of months. I don't anticipate I'll be able to go. So I don't know what's going to happen. I'm really my heart goes out to, you know, Italy and the partners that I work with in particular. They're all okay. Actually, I've checked in on everyone. So that's good news. But, you know, even some of these factories, and I work with several factories, they're really small family-run factories. They've been in the business for generations, but they're going to be really hard hit. And even when I was in Italy, in Milan, there was already discussions about it, because most of the luxury business is done in Asia. So the high-end designers rely on the Asia markets from a consumer standpoint, from a consumer demand perspective. And a lot of the factories work really closely with China and Japan in particular. And so I think it's going to be really tough. I don't know how this is all going to play out. I keep thinking, oh, when will I be able to go back to Italy? I hope I will be able to go. And even just, you know, 2-3 weeks ago, before we were really sheltered in, and I realized, well, we're on the same track as Italy in the US. What is that going to look like for us? So I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen. There's a lot of uncertainty right now all around the world. So hard to know.
And so talk a little bit about that. It must be there must be some disappointment around what you thought the anniversary was going to look like and what's going on in the world right now. It is just, it's so crazy. And yeah, could you talk a little bit about how is this all affecting your business and your anniversary that you were hoping to celebrate?
Yeah, happy to share. You know, the business was, and, you know, I don't know where things are going to go. Things were on a really nice path. And February, I was coming off of a tremendous February, the biggest month I'd ever had. And finally, really starting to turn the corner to a place where I felt like, wow, okay, I got a business here. This is happening. And it must have been, and the first week of March was still pretty decent. And then it was that first Monday after, we weren't sheltering in place yet, but my kids' school closed and everybody was home. And it was literally as if it was just, there was a cliff and the business fell off of it. I mean, literally, it was from one day to the next. And, you know, to some extent to be expected, it just somehow felt so jarring as it happened. And of course, I'm not the only one. I mean, I'm in the same boat as many, many small business owners and, quite frankly, large business owners. Everybody, anybody that's in the service industry, it all felt the same. It just was so abrupt. I think what was particularly hard was that there was just this momentum that was happening, excitement around seeing the business going in such a great direction and tons of product ideas. I had literally also just gotten back from Italy. So that was the other sort of irony in all of this. I had just been on a buying trip. I was in Milan. And, you know, there were whisperings, or I guess stronger than whisperings. You know, it was starting to feel like, okay, there's something happening. there is this disease, we need to worry about it. I was sort of iffy about, well, do I need to wear a mask at the airport? But I showed up at the airport, nobody was wearing a mask. I got to Milan, they checked my temperature, but in terms of what it felt like to be in Milan at the time, you felt nothing. Nobody was wearing masks, millions of people on the street eating, bars, restaurants. I was, you know, at a shoe show that was pretty well attended, though I think slower than typical. The show itself typically has a pretty high percentage of Asian clients and buyers that attend. And so I would say that was down quite a bit relative to what I had seen historically. But other than that, it just felt sort of like business as usual. And the day I got back, I read, you know, it was the first time I had heard rumblings that there was an outbreak in Italy. I had no idea. It was absolutely surreal. And, you know, I was fortunate in that and by the way, it wasn't really clear that I needed to stay at home for 2 weeks after I got back from Italy. You know, everything was still very muddy in terms of what was happening. So I suppose that what was happening with the business, but also what was just happening on a more personal level, all was kind of getting very mixed together for me. And the business kind of taking a nosedive, and it really truly was a nosedive, was just all kind of conflated with everything that was happening in the world, with, you know, my family more personally, with my kids, my husband's business. I mean, it was just all at once. So I would say that it, you know, felt all the more magnified in some sense because it was just everything at once. And I think everyone is experiencing it the same way. Everyone has got their own journey and story of, you know, where they were 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago and just sort of what was going on.
Wow. It's really intense to think that you were in Italy too, like coming back from Italy, one of the worst hit countries, and then coming back here and realizing, you know, that at the time when you were there, you didn't even, it wasn't clear that there was something pretty dangerous going on. And then, so did you isolate yourself when you got back, or was that not something that was at the time recommended?
It wasn't recommended. I didn't even think about it. And, you know, in retrospect, had I been infected, the damage that I personally would have done is tremendous. I mean, it's really kind of scary for me to think about it. I came back guns blazing. You know, I was at my kid's school for a board meeting the next day after I returned, was having, you know, networking lunches and dinner with friends. And, you know, I was out and about quite a bit. And I'm really fortunate that I wasn't sick. You know, I was kind of watching and waiting for those 14 days, but I didn't know that there, you know, was a possibility that I should have self-quarantined. I had no idea. And at the time when I returned, my daughter was actually really sick. As it turns out, it was coincidental. Oh, wow. And I was taking her to the doctor. And even then, they didn't even ask us about, you know, had anybody in the household been traveling? No one really exactly had Italy on their radar. It wasn't probably until a week after I returned that became a conversation point. And I realized, wait a minute, I was in, you know, this hot zone. I didn't know it. So the whole thing, as I said, it was pretty surreal. But yeah, I'm so grateful that I am healthy, that I didn't infect anyone, and, you know, hope to stay healthy, hope to remain that way.
Yeah. Oh my God. And when you think of how many people must have been in the exact same situation as you and just, you know, were traveling and not realizing that where this was going, it's so frightening.
It's frightening.
Oh my gosh.
Yes, absolutely.
And so how old are your kids?
I have two kids. They are 10 and 14.
Oh, okay. And they are the namesake of your company,
yes.
Correct?
Yes,
that's
correct.
That's their nicknames?
Correct, yes.
Okay, that's so cute. And so, well, obviously, I have a 7-year-old. She's been home, also a 19-year-old.
Oh.
Yeah, who has basically, I mean, I think he's basically dropped out of community college because of this, because he's just like, I don't get this, like, I can't do it. So it's been like really intense. And so it's not only realizing that your business is going through a big change that isn't probably a great change, and then also homeschooling your kids, everything's at home. It's just crazy. And so how has it been? Is there anything that you've been able to do to sort of pivot or sort of make changes in your business to try to mitigate the damage that this is all going to probably do?
I mean, that's a good question. So I definitely took a couple days to think about what the implications are for my business. And there are parts and pieces that make me feel okay and optimistic. And I did do some pivoting, and I'll tell you what that is in a second. I'm still a small business, and the intention was to stay small and curated. And because of that, I didn't get ahead of myself, and I've been running the business out of my house, essentially. So the warehouse is still the garage, and I've been working with largely contractors to help support the business. I didn't take on more than I could chew. So I'm one of the fortunate ones in the sense that I'm not in a position where I have to let go of a bunch of employees, have, you know, tremendous rent and overhead that, you know, suddenly it's going to be hard to just, you know, cover payroll, cover rent. So I don't have a ton of overhead in the business. So that's an absolute plus. And it's very easy for me to just shut down a lot of the spending at a time when I don't have a ton of income coming in. But having said that, the pivots are around, well, how do I continue to engage the community of people that are, you know, excited and love the brand? And what can I do in a super scrappy way that I've, you know, and I've been very super scrappy all along, but, you know, what other ideas do I have that I can help support and kind of keep things going, keep people engaged enough so that I'm still around on the back end of this. And that's my goal. So a couple of things that I've done, and this is a little bit of a leap of faith for me. I decided to set up a home photo studio. You know, I have worked with a fantastic photographer, several photographers, but one in particular that I have partnered with over the last couple of years, who I think is, you know, I credit for a lot of the really beautiful photography that I have on the site. And that's not my, you know, strength or expertise or talent area, but, you know, times are tough. You got to do some things, right? So I went online and I figured out how to put together a very basic, you know, kind of home studio. I have a number of products that are kind of one-off, one-of-a-kind items that are samples that I would have ordered along the way that didn't end up necessarily making it into the collection for one reason or another, but beautiful items. And I have done sample sales along the way. But so as a smaller example, I decided to just photograph all of those items, and I'm going to run a sample sale pretty soon. I'm almost completed all of the work to get that up and running. So, I mean, that's a really small example of one of the things that I've done. What I have seen, you know, I've sort of been gathering data to sort of watch and learn what's happening with a lot of other direct-to-consumer businesses that are trying to figure this out. And I think there are different paths that I've seen people take. One path is, all right, I'm going to kind of just take a little bit of a break, slow down, but spend my time engaging with my community and creating content. That's one path. Not necessarily revenue driving path, but it is at least a path to continue to engage and work with people that are, you know, supportive of the brand. And I think that's absolutely critical right now. There's another path of, oh my God, I've gotten pretty far ahead of myself, or I'm a venture-backed company that has been driving towards growth. And so therefore, I'm very unprofitable, have tremendous overhead. I have opened a fleet of stores to drive growth, and now I have to lay everybody off or sequester all of my employees and, you know, that worked in the retail spaces. So there's all of that. And most of what I've seen from a lot of those companies is tremendous, you know, impact to the employees. So big layoffs and also very aggressive promotion. So big, you know, what I would consider to be bigger, more established direct-to-consumer businesses, a la Everlane, for example, running 25% off. I'd never seen that before. They've never been promotional. So there's, you know, that path. And, you know, so you sort of see that. And then there's a third path, which is also a giving path. And I think a lot of companies have really embraced the idea that, okay, well, if nothing else, let's see if we can engage our customers and also, you know, have some elements of wanting to give back to the community, which I think is great when it's part of the ethos of your brand. It feels a little bit more inauthentic when it's not necessarily. So I think everyone's trying to find their path. For my business, it's a little bit about, you know, how can I just sort of quietly weather the storm? The inventory that I have is, I would say, really classic and seasonless for the most part. And I did that very much by design. I don't see any reason why, at least I hope that this is the case, that when we come out of this, the inventory will be any less relevant to the customer that understands what the brand is about and really embraces the brand ethos, and hopefully will be there and still interested. It's just, it is tough in particular for non-essential and luxury goods right now, right? Those are the categories that are going to be the hardest hit, and particularly luxury goods, because it's all nice to have product. It's not need to have. And it's not just a factor of people not leaving their homes and not going anywhere. So they really don't need to dress up. They certainly don't need to wear, you know, what I would consider to be beautiful luxury Italian footwear right now. And so that makes it really tough. It just does. Those categories are going to be super hard hit. So yeah. Long-winded answer to your question. Yes, I've pivoted to some extent. Yes, I'm sort of just holding off. I don't want to just promote away the brand. That scares me as well. And the hope is just to kind of stop spending and, you know, batten down the hatches as much as I can so that I can come out of this on the other side with the business still intact and inventory that I think is still relevant, a customer base that hopefully is still engaged, and, you know, a business model that hopefully will continue to maintain me for the long term. But as of right now, it's not easy.
You know, it sounds like you have really set up your business, though, in the best way you possibly could have, you know, not knowing there was going to be a disaster like this happening. You've really been fairly conservative about your business and created a business that would be protected just in case. And maybe you didn't have that on your mind, but I'm just curious, what was your thinking going into building the business as far as, you know, being conservative with how much you were producing and how much you were investing, like not taking investment and, you know, all of that?
Yeah, it's, I suppose it was to some extent by design, but not because I anticipated, to your point, a pandemic, right? I set out to build a profitable small business. That is my goal. I am bootstrapping the business. I did not take, and I'm very fortunate that, you know, I'm at a stage in my life and a position financially where I could, you know, we could take some of our personal savings and put it into a business and roll the dice. But in doing so, when it's your own money, your own capital, the way you think about growth is going to be very different than when you take outside investment. It just is. And in particular, venture money. You know, I knew that I wanted to be really curated and special, and I didn't want to feel the pressure of having to grow the business and acquire customers in ways that force you to do things that are really outside of what you want to do from a product perspective and start pushing you to expand categories and, you know, as I said, acquire customers sometimes in ways it just doesn't really feel like authentic to where you want to go with the brand. And so I have been really careful and conservative. Now, as a result, my growth is a lot more conservative as well. In my second year of business, I doubled the business from the first year. And now that sounds like a great result. But for a venture-backed company, that would not be considered good enough. You know, I think what you typically read or hear is at least a tripling, if not a quadrupling of a business. And it's really easy to do that. If you throw money at digital marketing and you open pop-up stores all over the country, you're going to grow the business. It's just at what cost and how much are you spending to get there? The other place where I was very conservative and slow to go was with digital marketing, paid digital advertising specifically through largely Facebook and Instagram. I have had a lot of just, I would say, pure failures in terms of spending money and not seeing results. A venture-backed company will spend money and a lot of it to drive, you know, in some cases, just top of the funnel awareness. But when you're a bootstrap company and you need to convert customers, that just doesn't work. You know, every click needs to at some point convert. It's not just about awareness. And awareness is important, especially in a luxury category. It's a considered purchase. You don't necessarily show up on a website and look at a pair of $350 shoes and say, sure, I'm going to pull the trigger on that. I don't need more information. Probably not. You need to see it maybe 3 or 4 times, right? Or, you know, several times. But every dollar spent, if I spent a dollar and didn't see a return, it made me scratch my head. And I would, you know, very often just, you know, pull the trigger and cut things off. Because if it's not working, it's not working. You know, from my perspective, if I can't see a conversion and I'm not seeing customers buying products, I got to shut it off. I can't continue to spend. So yes, you're right. I have been fortunate in that I've been slow and conservative and, you know, watching and learning. my perspective has been, you know, I'm going to try something once, and if it doesn't work, I'm not going to do it again. And I've tried lots of things that didn't work. And, you know, generally speaking, would look at the cost benefit analysis of every decision, every dollar going out. And, you know, is it worth my time? And so, it's, you know, I really value my time as well in all of this, because I'm a one woman show. There's nobody else to do it. And, you know, if I spend 8 hours at an event and I, you know, am able to generate $1,000, is that worth my time? I don't know that it is, actually, because I could be brainstorming and thinking about, you know, how to drive the business in a much, you know, much more thoughtful, strategic way. And, you know, those hours could be spent doing something that will leverage the business a lot harder and faster. So as an example, that's how I was thinking about my decision-making process. And so, yeah, I am hopeful. I'm hopeful. And then just to answer one other part of your question, which is around the products that I chose and you know, what I put into the collection, I really went after special products. And we can talk a little bit about the sensibility and the product point of view. But the idea is that it's still classic and there's longevity to the product. And then I'm building on, you know, items that are working really well, because in footwear, you know, you don't need to turn the page that quickly in footwear. A good shoe is a good shoe for a really long time. And that's been my experience over the years, having worked in the shoe business for ages. You know, there, you can think about the classic shoes that are in your closet that are still relevant from days gone by, and you still pull them out and you still love them. And there's something 100%. There. You know?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
So, you know, that's what I really went after from a product point of view as well.
So did you ever consider opening a storefront, a physical space?
Yeah. When you asked the question, it made me really think about what my perspective was on that prior to this COVID-19 pandemic. What was happening is that Facebook, the cost for paid digital advertising has really skyrocketed. And the way I think about it is that Facebook in particular is capturing a lot of the what I call rents of customer acquisition. So much money is going to Facebook to acquire customers. To the point where you almost get to a place where you're spending so much with Facebook, you could very easily make the argument, well, maybe I'd be better off opening a store. Huh. That's how much I had been spending with Facebook. I was starting to kind of tip the balance in that direction. So you can kind of make your way towards thinking that, well, maybe from an awareness standpoint, it's just as easy to open a store. You have to staff it, so there are costs associated with that. But there's, you know, something really attractive potentially about, at least, you know, it's all within your own control, as opposed to paying everything over to Facebook and having them, you know, kind of controlling your destiny in terms of who sees your ads and whether or not they're the right target audience, et cetera. And now, clearly, everything is different, you know, with everyone sheltering in place and, you know, every store is essentially closed down. I think that what happens on the backside of all of this and how direct-to-consumer businesses think about their growth is going to look really different. Many, many venture-backed direct-to-consumer businesses were, you know, I think they were pushed into opening stores and expanding very quickly because that's the fastest way to drive growth. And those are the companies I think that have suffered the most. I'm talking specifically about D2C native brands specifically, not department store businesses necessarily, because those businesses were brick and mortar first and then moved to online. So I don't know how all this is going to shake out on the back end. You know, I've read some articles and heard some prognostications that, you know, 25% of retail will be wiped out post COVID-19, which is, that's huge. What that looks like in terms of the, you know, brick and mortar balance versus online, digital, it's hard to know, but I think it's all going to be really different when this is all over. So,
yeah, I love that you talked about like trying lots of things that failed. And so you try something else. And I wonder if you're that resilience or and that like just ability to be like, okay, that didn't work, move on, try something else. Do you think that has come with, as you've gotten older and more experienced in your career, that you've been able to take that approach? Or is that an approach that you learned early on in business school? Or I'm curious if you had a different approach earlier in your career.
That's an interesting question. I would say that I learned it along the way. It's, I think, probably years of experience. I can think back to being a buyer. You know, as a buyer, you have to make decisions. You have to buy, right? That's the job of a buyer. And so you're forced to what I call pull the trigger. You got to pull the trigger. You know, you got to buy something. You can't just hold off and wait and look and see and maybe, and I don't know, you've got money to spend, you need to spend it. And what I learned along the way is if you make a mistake, you can fix it. That's something that, you know, I know I've built that confidence over the years, and that's just a matter of having done it so many times and having made so many mistakes along the way and seeing that, you know, in retrospect, well, I was always able to figure that one out every time. There was never a situation that I wasn't able to figure out. So yeah, I think it just comes with years of experience having, you know, failed and won and, you know, lost so many times.
Yeah. And it seems like when you read about entrepreneurs in the media, it's often millennials, it's often younger people are thought of as entrepreneurs. And I just hearing you talk, it seems to me that it's actually like an older person is a bit more set up to be successful as an entrepreneur because of all of the experience that you have. And so I wonder if that, did you ever consider going out on your own earlier in your career, or did you just feel ready as you, you know, had all the years behind you in your work?
I would say that it took me a while to get there. I've always been actually somewhat risk averse in a way and sort of conservative with my own career and felt like I needed to take a very traditional path. And it wasn't until later stage in my career that I finally, I think, had the confidence and the wherewithal to say, okay, it's time. I've got this. But also to answer your question, it's interesting. I read a lot of articles about, you know, what is the perfect profile of an entrepreneur? Is it somebody who's in their 20s, who's, you know, super aggressive and, you know, risk tolerant and creative and all of those things? And certainly there are countless examples of very successful entrepreneurs who have dropped out of college, and especially being in Silicon Valley or, you know, sort of in this tech environment. And for me, as a kind of, I would say, second career entrepreneur, if you will, is definitely later stage in my life. I felt a little bit like a fish out of water, but I'm reading more articles now that absolutely suggest that the most successful entrepreneurs are either, you know, sort of that younger millennial profile, or even pre-millennial, I suppose, at this point, or people that are, you know, kind of second stage life in life a little bit, and who, you know, do bring the experience, the business skill, you know, the connections and the network that I've developed over the years has really benefited me, for example, and for many, access to capital when you're older is much easier. So I don't see any reason why, and in particular for women, you know, sort of late stage entrepreneurship isn't absolutely embraced. And I believe that there are lots of paths to success for later stage entrepreneurs. But having said all that, I sometimes feel just culturally like a fish out of water, especially in Silicon Valley. There's all this like very aggressive sort of, especially the like, you know, alpha male, machismo, blah, blah, blah. I just don't care about any of it. And I think there's some elements of that too. And I think that's, you know, what is so kind of incredible, I suppose, about being, you know, a woman at this stage in my career, which is that I kind of just don't care, you know, yeah. I don't care what anybody else thinks. I've been there, I've done it. I know what to do, and I have a lot of confidence in that. I've never been an entrepreneur, but I, as I said before, I've made mistakes and I figured it out and always bounced back, and I'm sure I'm going to figure this one out too.
That's great. I love that. And I think that does come with getting older, is the not caring if you fit in with some certain type of group that, you know, is prevalent, like the Silicon Valley, the whole scene. It's just, it must feel a little bit freeing.
Yeah. You know, even when I talked about earlier, the idea that I wanted to build a small curated business that hopefully I can bootstrap and, you know, I'll probably at some point need some outside capital to, you know, continue the growth trajectory of the business. But the idea that I wasn't setting out to, you know, build the next big, I don't know what, is really anathema to what you hear people talking about also in Silicon Valley. Everybody wants the next big, whatever it is, because everyone's looking for, you know, for it's an ego thing, but it's also a money thing for a lot of people. And it's not about that for me. I'm not interested in building Bells and Becks to sell it to someone else, or, you know, to have it go public. And that's not really what I'm aspiring to. actually want this to be my career. I want to run this business. And in a perfect world, I would love to leave this to my children, you know, and have a legacy there. And I want them to see that. And so this is it for me, I'm hoping. You know, I want this to sort of be my career now.
Yeah.
Until, you know, whatever happens at the end, you know, until retirement. And that's really different. It's a really different perspective. And so sometimes I have to kind of keep that a little bit to myself because I don't feel it's certainly not the established way around here. But I do feel like it's freeing in that sense. I know what I'm trying to set out to do. It may be different than what other people are looking to do, but it's my journey.
I love that. Yeah. And that sort of dovetails with something I wanted to talk about, which is the design of your shoes and the sort of age inclusive approach that you seem to have. I don't know if I'm just making that up, but I feel like you do. Would you say that you take an age inclusive approach?
Absolutely. Again, I don't know that I thought about it that way when I started the business. What I knew when I launched was that there was something missing in the marketplace. And I was feeling it both for myself as well as the community of women around me. And that was that it felt like there was a category of products. And well, actually, just take a step back even further. Direct-to-consumer businesses in particular, for the most part, to me, felt like they were all targeting millennials. Both from a product sensibility, a positioning, the models they were using, just everything. It was, you know, really going after a younger consumer, which makes a lot of sense because for the most part, it was really a younger demographic that was embracing e-commerce and online purchasing in general. And brand building online was happening in these ways that specifically was, you know, it was all kind of symbiotic in the sense that, well, who's using Instagram and who's using, well, now it's TikTok and whatever, all these other platforms, but it was largely a younger demographic. And so all the brands were really kind of moving in that direction. And what I saw was, you know, a missing element in terms of, okay, well, who's going after, you know, a Gen X woman, not only in terms of how we're being spoken to and marketed to, but just from a product perspective. In terms of the category footwear specifically, and this goes across a lot of fashion apparel, everything was feeling very gender neutral to me and very heavy and clunky. And my personal aesthetic and the aesthetic of many women that I was seeing around me is actually you want to embrace your femininity. There are women who want to feel really like product is feminizing and sleek and beautiful, and feminine doesn't have to mean flowery and, you know, saccharine sweet or something, but there's a power to a certain type of femininity. And there's a functional element, which is for me personally, I was a busy executive and a mom, and I was, you know, going out with friends, and I had, you know, volunteer work and whatever. I was doing a million things. I was traveling, and I couldn't wear high, beautiful designer shoes anymore. And I believe me, I love shoes and I love designer shoes and I love high heels. I love all of those things. But what I was starting to wear to work in particular when I was traveling is either mid heels or flats. And when I found one that was quality, so it was either from a designer or it was like borderline designer or something in between that was still a beautiful leather product. Maybe it was made in Italy, but not usually. It was comfortable, but it was also really chic and beautiful. I felt like, well, this is something I'm going to wear the heck out of. And I found myself buying those shoes over and over and over again, sometimes searching online for the exact same pair and buying them, you know, either two or three pairs of the same thing, because those are the shoes that were my go-tos. So when I started the business, that was the target. It was this idea of beautiful, chic, but also functional footwear that's super wearable that ultimately works for both an older and younger consumer, but it doesn't alienate an older consumer. And in fact, when I polled a bunch of women and asked them how has their point of view shifted in terms of their wardrobe and, you know, kind of what they see themselves wearing, they all are super chic women. They all want to look and feel put together and feminine and have confidence, but they can't wear high heels anymore. They need something that is both functional and flattering and still chic and cool. And they're all like amazing, cool women that want to look great, but they can't wear high heels. So yes, I suppose there's an inclusivity because I'm, you know, very comfortable talking to that woman. And then, you know, just in terms of the look and feel of the site and, you know, as I've really shifted towards thinking about this customer, just even thinking about the use of the model and what she's doing and, you know, how she's wearing the shoes. All of those things are really important. And I think, you know, definitely open the, you know, aperture for bringing, I think, an older consumer into the fold.
Yeah. I definitely fall into that category of not being able to wear high heels anymore, unfortunately. And, you know, it's so, I wish my younger self would have realized that wearing 6-inch, 5-inch heels was going to be bad for my feet in the long run. But, you know, I probably wouldn't have listened to myself anyway. But yeah, I just am very grateful that companies like yours are making really cute footwear that is feminine. And I love what you said about it being, you know, feminine, functional, but not, that doesn't mean it's like flowery and somehow not a, like a strong look.
Yeah.
Not something that I've enjoyed discovering about just sort of fashion and my interest in fashion. When I first became interested in fashion, I kind of tried to shrug it off because I thought, oh, that's sort of vacuous, or it's not something that is going to, like, I won't be taken seriously if I'm too into fashion, because I used to be a tech writer at a tech publication. But what I've come to realize is that femininity does not equal weakness. You can be a feminist and be feminine. You know, it's not all mutually exclusive. And I love that your company sort of encompasses all of that.
Agree. Yes.
Yeah.
And absolutely.
I particularly love the mules with the tassels. I think they're
the Morella.
Cute. Yeah.
Thank you.
I really
love it. Yeah, that was the first shoe that we launched with, actually. It was part of the inaugural collection, and it's, you know, it's been in the line now for 2 years and doesn't slow down. Women love that shoe. It's great.
That's awesome. And that is the cool thing about shoes, is that it's not like clothing where if you have to have this churn of like new designs all the time. Like you mentioned earlier, you can, if there's something that people love, they're going to keep coming back for it.
Absolutely. Exactly. Yeah. And what I've seen on, you know, the other thing that I've learned as I've moved through this process, I suppose that I knew it intuitively, having been a shoe buyer and a merchant for so many years, you know, feet are, so women's bodies, of course, it's very personal. Every woman has a different body. And in particular, though, the feet, there's always a story with women's feet.
That's so true.
And women don't talk about it very often, except that I feel like I'm the foot doctor. You know, sometimes when I do a pop-up or an event, and immediately women start telling me about, you know, I have a wide foot, or I have a really narrow foot, or it's funny, or I have a bunion, or I have an aroma. I mean, you name it, women are talking to me about what's going on with
their
feet.
Whether you like it or not.
Whether I like it or not. And what's amazing is that I have, you know, over the course of the short amount of time, kind of developed a collection of shoes that I sort of know, okay, well, this shoe's going to work really well if you've got a wider foot and maybe you have a bit of a bunion and it's a really forgiving style. This one works if you've got a narrower foot. And so actually building a collection around this sort of spectrum of, you know, differences there, believe it or not. And the Morella in particular, the shoe with the tassels, is a particularly forgiving shoe and works for a lot of different women. I sell a lot of really big sizes in that shoe. And, you know, when women have really big feet, they're usually a little bit wider. They're always like issues. Women with big feet are always also coming up to me saying, well, I have a huge foot. I can never find shoes. I'm like, I have a shoe for you, Miss the Morella.
Oh, that's so awesome.
Yeah.
I had a feeling just by looking at that shoe, actually, because I have small feet, but they're kind of wide. And
oh, see, there you go.
Yeah. And I had a feeling by looking at that, I was like, I think that shoe would work for my foot, just the way it's shaped or something. I had a good feeling about it. So, yeah.
All right, well, we'll have to get you a pair so you can try them.
I would love to buy a pair, actually. So yeah, I've been thinking about it. And like you said, it's the kind of thing where you're going to sleep on it. You're going to be like, that's a really great shoe. Let me think about that. You know, it's not like, you're on Amazon buying something for $30 or whatever. So it's different.
Exactly. Yeah. It's not a quick pull the trigger.
Right.
I use that term in lots of places.
Yeah. So, yes. Yeah. So we talked a little bit about getting older and, you know, how it feels to be in your career as you get older. Is there anything that you find is just much better now than it was when you were younger? Or maybe more than one thing?
Yeah. Well, so I did just turn 50.
Oh, wow.
In February. Yeah.
Happy birthday.
I had my big, thank you. That was all crazy too, just thinking about the timing before all of this went down.
Oh my gosh. I'm glad that you got to celebrate before the lockdown.
I did. I was really fortunate in that. You know, I think I alluded to it earlier. I just have more confidence than I ever have in myself and my abilities. And I guess I would say that I have a comfort in my own skin that I feel like it's taken me a long time to get to. I've accepted, you know, all the like lumps and bumps and all the things, you know, that you have to sort of come to accept in your body and your soul. I do a lot of yoga now, and I actually started doing yoga in my 30s, but I would say it's the last 10 years in particular that I've started to really embrace. You know, in my 30s, I sort of did yoga because it felt good and it was more about exercise.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say in my late 40s in particular, I started to do yoga more for the sort of mind-body connection and the spiritual aspect of, you know, helping me just kind of get out of my mind and center myself. And I guess it sounds a little new agey, but it works.
Yeah,
and
so
that, you know, sort of that comfort in my own skin, the feeling that, you know, I can do things with my body still that feel really good, and I can do things with my mind, and I can pivot and shift, and I have the courage to, you know, leave my very comfortable corporate job and start a business from scratch. I'm not sure that I could have, you know, we sort of talked about this earlier. I don't think I could have done it earlier in my career. I just know that I wasn't there mentally. So I would say that's a big shift for me now that I've, you know, turned the corner to 50. And that all feels really good. You know, I would say the other big factor is family, and the stage that my family is in right now is very different than when I was in my 30s and just having my kids. And it sounds like, you know, you've got, you know, a younger one at home and also an older one. So you know there's a big difference between having really young children and how physically demanding that is. And, you know, you're exhausted all the time and you're sleep deprived and, you know, you're just holding your, you know, 2-year-old, you know, back from running all over the place. And
right.
But then when they shift into a place where they're a little bit older, their needs are really different. And what I found for myself, and part of the reason why I really wanted to build a business right now and get away from the kind of corporate environment, was that I wanted to be a lot more present, both physically and, you know, just emotionally present for my, you know, now entering teenager. Now I have one teenage kids. They need a lot of emotional support. They just need more than I ever expected they were going to need. And I want to be present and available to them. So that's a big shift that happened for me, you know, in the last couple of years. And, you know, as I turn 50, I reflect on that for sure.
Yeah, that is, I have found that too with our 19-year-old. I just imagined, you know, as a teenager, he would just sort of be very independent and not like really want me around or not want to talk to me that much. But it's not the case. Like, he wants to talk all the time. Like, he, you know, and not that he would ever admit to his friends that he wants to talk to me or even admit to me that he wants to talk to me. But it's just a fact that there's a lot of communicating and a lot of, like you said, emotional support that is really necessary with teenagers that I never anticipated at all. Because when they're little, you're like, oh, it's going to be so much easier when they're older. And it's like easier in some ways, but it's harder in other ways. So
It's tough.
It really is.
You know, I guess the other thing I'll say is, and I guess this is, you know, the answers are all very personal and not so much about the business, but I think I'm a better partner than I ever have been at this stage in my life, because I, you know, we've been through a lot, as, you know, so my husband and I have been married for 16 years and, you know, we've learned how to communicate and how to support one another and be there for each other in lots of different ways. You know, he's an incredible support to me as I launch the business and, you know, continue through this very difficult chapter right now. And I think I'm, you know, available to him emotionally in a way that I wasn't before. And we're, you know, we've connected in a really good way. And I think that just also comes with maturity and time and experience being in a relationship. And I don't know.
That's so great.
Maybe it's,
though.
Yeah. I mean, I think we're fortunate in a lot of ways, but I also think it comes from my own, you know, confidence and comfort in what I'm doing and So my ability to give, I think I have a greater ability to give in some ways than I did before.
That's interesting. That makes sense though, because as you get older, or I mean, I can speak for myself, I feel hopefully a little less selfish. I have the ability to think of others a little bit more than mm-hmm. I did before. I feel grateful that I sort of stuck out our marriage this long because mm-hmm. I don't know, there were difficult times, you know, and yeah. could have gone, you know, different ways, but it makes me really grateful that we stuck it out and that now we're in this place where we do have the ability to sort of communicate better. And like you, just everything you were saying, I feel similarly about my own marriage. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So youngsters out there listening, stick it out if you can.
Yeah, it's tough. It's tough.
It is really hard sometimes.
And, you know, yeah. And being, you know, in a small confined space with, you know, a spouse and partner and children. Oof.
Yeah, stick it out
it
if
puts
it's
everything to the test.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. It's so hard right now. Yeah, this is definitely a test of anyone's marriage, this whole sheltering in place thing. Oh my gosh. Yeah. And so one other thing I wanted to ask you about is you know, you've been in fashion for a very long time. And are you noticing a change or a shift in the way women of our age are portrayed, like by brands as well as just sort of in the media in general?
Absolutely. You know, I would say that the quintessential kind of meme, I don't know, it was circulating, I guess, in late January, early February after the Super Bowl. It was, you know, the picture of Betty White at 50, the picture of J-Lo at 50.
Yes.
Right, in the Super Bowl, right? I mean, that to me epitomizes everything about the shift that we're seeing right now and how we're seeing women portrayed. There have been, you know, many articles written now that I've read about, you know, women in the media, women in fashion to some extent, not as much I would say, but, you know, actresses, women in politics. So there's this shift towards this, you know, powerful, strong woman, whatever that looks like. And the idea of what it once was and what it is today is really, really different. And it's so exciting to see that. And it's really energizing for someone like me in particular, who's, you know, second stage career, late stage entrepreneur, just turned 50 myself, and, you know, running a business that is really gearing up towards wanting to support, you know, an older generation of women who still, you know, are, you know, not only are they as vibrant as they, you know, once were, but they're, one could argue, even more vibrant, right? There is this kind of coming out, I would say, of, you know, this generation of women now that are saying, wait a minute, I'm incredibly bright. I, you know, have accomplished a ton in my career. I'm incredibly well connected. I'm comfortable in my own skin. I'm confident, all, you know, all of the things. And I'm here and I'm doing something and I'm making a mark. And so you're just seeing that portrayed more frequently. You're seeing it in, you know, more, you know, amazing roles that, you know, older women are taking on leading roles in film to some extent. And, you know, I think about, you know, the women in politics right now and, you know, how they're really taking a center stage in a way that they haven't historically. And I'm reading more and more. And, you know, the work that you're doing is just really a testament to that as well.
Oh, gosh. You know, I hope so. Thank you.
Absolutely. I'm so excited about what you're doing. And, you know, you're seeing it everywhere. I just came back from my 20-year Harvard Business School reunion.
Oh, wow.
And it was pretty amazing to reconnect with, you know, a lot of old friends and acquaintances and, you know, just to see where everybody is at. And I will say that, you know, the women are doing pretty well, you know, the men are doing great too. So, you know, it's pretty much across the board, but my, you know, women friends from my class and, I would say a large number of my friends that, you know, kind of harken back to that business school time, they're just awesome. They're awesome. They're doing so many really cool, interesting things and they're just involved in, you know, everything you could think about and just they're creative and they're, you know, analytical and they're thoughtful and they're just amazing, an amazing group of women. And I just feel grateful to be a part of that community. And I see it. It's not just a business school community. It's just everywhere. So many of the amazing mentors that I've had over the years who are, you know, actually a little bit older than me already. And in retail in particular, you know, the former president of Old Navy just promoted to CEO. How exciting.
So exciting.
The CEO of Gap Inc. And many of the women that, you know, I looked up to at many times, you know, different points in my career are just all doing really cool, incredible things with their career now. And they're all also amazing moms and amazing partners. And, you know, these are women that you look to and say, well, one day, you know, I hoped one day to be them. And now I feel like, okay, well, I'm on my journey. You know, maybe I've arrived. I don't know. I don't know if I've arrived, but I'm still striving to be like what that is, you know? So yeah. Having those kind of, you know, women out there and seeing them portrayed in that way is just so, it's great. It's so exciting.
I agree. And it's really exciting to see the shift happening everywhere, like media, social media, music with J-Lo. And mm-hmm. we actually did a whole episode on the Super Bowl for her Super Bowl performance. Yeah. Because I have a good friend who is a Latino woman, and she was so excited about that show. And we were both like, loved it. But then there's like the other side of it where you're like, I mean, it's amazing to see someone who's 50 years old doing all of that. But then sometimes you're like, you look in the mirror and you're like, well, I don't exactly look like J-Lo,
right.
hopefully it's still cool to be 50, you know?
Exactly.
So, I mean, that's just a, you know, there's a sort of looksism factor, no matter how old you are, I guess. But
it's unfortunate because, you know, we're women and we're our, you know, worst critics and, you know, we're hypercritical, you know, of ourselves. And so it's true. And yes, J-Lo is, you know, an outlier. Of course she is. Right.
For sure.
But still, you know, it's still pretty incredible when you think about the portrayal of that, you know, kind of 50-year-old persona, as I said, versus what once was a 50-year-old and how so different today than it once was.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. I'm grateful to be 50 now than, I'm glad I'm 50 now rather than 20 years ago.
Yes, me too. Me too. Even though I will also just throw in that, you know, being sheltered in, suddenly I feel a little bit like, you know, all of the kind of domestic, well, there's a lot of domestic work that seems to be falling on the women more so than I would have expected.
Yes.
There's still a division of labor, but the balance, I would say, still is sort of sitting in my camp.
Yeah, that is very hard. It's very hard for me because my work is, you know, technically part-time. So it kind of makes sense in the balance of everything that it would fall on me. But at the same time, I'm like, well, I'm trying to build something. And if I don't have time to build it, then it's not going to grow. You know, I feel like I'm sort of in a bit of a catch-22 thing. Because if you don't have time to put your energy into something, then it can't grow. But, you know, my husband has a full-time job and he's the primary breadwinner, basically. So it's tough. It's very hard domestically right now. I'm sure a lot of women are feeling that kind of imbalance and frustration right now.
Yeah, I'm sure that's true. Absolutely.
Well, Tamar, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me. It was really fun chatting with you. And I wish you thank you. And I wish the brand and you the best. I have a feeling you guys are going to come out of this with, you know, even stronger on the other end.
Thank you so much, Kristen. And keep doing what you're doing. Build it.
Thank you.
You're doing something really important and you're doing it really well. And, you know, I just know you have a tremendous fan in your corner.
Oh, I appreciate that so much. Thank you so much.
And be healthy and safe.
It's same to you. Stay healthy.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank
Take
you.
Care.
All right.
Okay.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Thanks so much for listening to the Mean Podcast. Please check out the online magazine at www.meanmagazine.com and get in touch if you or someone you know should be featured in the magazine or on the podcast.